Hi, it's David Locke, host of Locked On NBA, founder of the Locked On Podcast Network. Great guest today, Kevin Pelton, on the impact of all that's happened in the NBA playoffs and how it changes the league and what types of players we're looking at and the Warriors and the Rockets and everything. It's great, but I've got a huge announcement for you. Last year, our single most listened to program of the year was our epic 5-day mock draft. It is back, coming at you with all of its glory, starting next week. Jeremy Wu of Sports Illustrated will be our draft expert, giving you breakdowns on all of the picks, and we will take you pick by pick through 30 picks of the NBA draft with your local experts of the Locked On Podcast Network on each and every pick. We're very excited for this. It will start on Wednesday, the mock draft, with picks 1 through 6, and then move. Each day, we will also have a Reddit AMA going on at 1 o'clock Eastern with those people who've taken the picks of that day. So picks 1 through 6 will have a Reddit AMA about their draft on at 1 o'clock Eastern on Wednesday. Thursday it'll be picks 7 through 12. You can figure it out from there. So very exciting for the Locked On Podcast Network to have that coming up for you. And we're really, really fired up to bring you the best 5-day mock draft with all the local experts on the biggest stories. In the meantime, here's the ultra wonderful Kevin Pelton. And as always, send him a thank you for coming on at @KPelton on Twitter.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Our semi-regular, I don't know, that's periodical, I don't know the right word, Kevin Pelton, ESPN insider, superstar of all sorts of different ilk, has some great pieces up right now. One on his Draymond Green Hall of Famer, another on Brian Colangelo, and another on best postseason runs with LeBron James. We got a lot of things to talk about. Largely, though, Kevin, I kind of want, what have we learned? How has the league changed? We always talk about it's a copycat league. We kind of know now the Warriors are going to win the title. Switching is in vogue. What are your big postseason takeaways right now?
I think it's fascinating how the draft process that is simultaneously going on seems to be contrasting with what we're seeing play out in the playoffs, which is that teams are having a difficult time keeping multiple big men on the court. They're, you know, having to kind of scheme around them to some extent or be willing to let them switch out on guards because of the fact that there's so much switching going on, as you mentioned. And yet, you know, you look at the Jonathan Givony draft, mock draft on ESPN Insider today, the top three players in that mock are all big men, only maybe one of which, maybe two, you know, you would say can switch, but that's not definitely going to be DeAndre Ayton's strength. And, you know, we'll see. That's probably how Marvin Bagley is going to have to defend. And maybe Jaren Jackson can do it. And I think he does have a fairly modern game for a five-man in the NBA. But is that really the direction you'd want to go right now? It seems like wings are the biggest need in the league.
You bring up a great point to it. The concern I have on this, though, is, are we just talking about playing the Rockets and the Warriors? Or was that really the story of the whole playoffs, right? The Jazz beat Oklahoma City in the first round playing two bigs. New Orleans swept the wings or the dynamic guards of Portland. And I get a little nervous, particularly after watching Golden State in Game 3. You know what? Like, trying to build anything to beat Golden State, I admire what Houston's done, and we need to talk about it. But, I mean, it's just absurd last night. Last night was, like, the most helpless night for anyone in the NBA. Steph and Clay aren't good, and the Warriors still win because Durant's that good. How much are you making a mistake if you start building your team based on what you have to do to Houston and Golden State, or is that what you have to do?
I mean, I don't think it's just Houston and Golden State. You look at Boston's success in the playoffs, which was probably more fragile than it was seen as being when they were, you know, leading at various points the Eastern Conference Finals. But how much of it was the fact that the last couple of years they've gone out and drafted versatile wing players in the, you know, in the top five picks, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. Tatum being a fairly obvious selection where he was taken, but also being the result of them being willing to trade down from number one and not take the consensus, you know, the favored number one pick, Markelle Fultz. And then Jaylen Brown being someone who, you know, my highest draft projections were very low on, very, very, very low on, and wasn't necessarily going to be taken third by anyone else, but the Celtics believed in him and drafted him, and those two guys didn't play a crucial role in their playoff run. So, you know, I think that the whole you can't win with bigs, that element is probably overstated, but the value of interchangeable wings, I don't think is overstated.
Okay, so I think Boston was terrific, but their biggest strength is geographic.
I mean, that's not unfair, but they beat a really good Philly team that I don't know if you felt this way going into the series, but I thought was a solid favorite going into that series. And, you know, that series might have gone a different way if some of the close outcomes had gone differently or Philly could make a three-pointer at some point in that series. But certainly the Celtics' wings were important to that success.
Yeah, well, I read some tweets about that series from Philadelphia's standpoint, and I just think people – Oh, wait, never mind. I mean, I don't want to discredit Boston. I do think they might have lost in the first round of the Western Conference playoffs.
No, I think that's very possible. I mean, I think Boston or Utah is an interesting question.
And, you know, is Utah the third best team in the Western Conference? Or, I mean, the numbers would actually almost say they might be the third. See, okay, so this gets interesting, right? So if you look at the numbers in the last two seasons, Utah was fifth in point differential last year, I think third or fourth in point differential, or at least in efficiency differential last year. They were higher than that post kind of, you know, when they got healthy this year, and they don't necessarily have that switchable lineup.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, and I don't think that everyone has to play a certain way. It's just that what's the easiest way to get there? You're not drafting Rudy Gobert with this top five pick. I mean, maybe you are in Mo Bamba, and that's going to be part of the decision-making process. But if you've got these centers that have question marks about how they're going to fit defensively into the modern game, why are you taking all of them over Luka Doncic, who is accomplishing unprecedented things in Europe?
Okay, so I don't understand why anyone's taking anyone over Luka Doncic. I just want to make, like, and I haven't watched a lot of these guys, but the winning EuroLeague and winning EuroBasket moves my meter.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are big accomplishments for a 19-year-old.
Right, far more, frankly, than moves my meter of winning the NCAA tournament. So maybe that's not fair.
which one of these guys did anyway?
Right. Good point. I sometimes, you know, college basketball is pretty hard to evaluate guys on. All right, so if this wing switchability is the in vogue thing, then what are the skill sets of offensive players that have been undervalued recently that now become valued more highly?
Yeah, this is something my colleague Zach Lowe has talked a lot about, you know, the value of the post game comes back in when you have these mismatches with switches. The ability to make a play one-on-one off the dribble really becomes important. And I think that's also a factor, even when you're not necessarily going one-on-one against a switch, but, you know, even having your role players be able to make a play against a hard closeout off the dribble. I thought that was something that hurt Houston in game one of the Western Conference Finals is, you know, when the Warriors got in rotation, they were willing to, basically live with Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute, who ended up not playing later in the series, and then even PJ Tucker making plays off the dribble because they felt like they could, you know, alter their shots enough at the rim to cause them to miss because those guys aren't comfortable in that situation. Whereas one of the things that's so great about the Warriors Hampton 5 lineup is that all five of those, not all five of those guys are great shooters, Green and Iguodala being iffy, but all of them, if you close out hard on them, they can put the ball on the ground and then make a play for someone else or for themselves.
When you listen to Mark Jackson, I just paused for effect. When you listen to Mark Jackson and Jeff Van Gundy during the series, they're complaining all the time that Cleveland is allowing too much space when there's non-shooters like Iguodala, Green, Bell on the floor. Is their criticism valid to Cleveland, or is there something about those players or Golden State system that makes it harder to just clog the middle and leave those guys? And is this what maybe you're getting to here?
Well, I mean, I think they can do more. I think Houston did more in that regard, in addition to what they were doing with, in terms of switching. I mean, they were prepared for that series against the Warriors in a way that Cleveland just wasn't and isn't and hasn't been. I mean, as Daryl Morey has said, they were obsessed with the Warriors, and that's reflected in their style of play. And it wasn't like, okay, now we're facing the Warriors, let's get ready to start switching. It was, no, we're going to spend 6 months getting our communication right, getting our understanding of timing on switches, and that's going to translate for us. It worked for them against other teams, but it's going to really translate for us in this series. So, I mean, I think that you can do more than Cleveland has in the finals. I think that criticism is valid. At the same time, if it were that easy as, oh, hey, just take off Draymond and Iguodala, and they'll shut down the Warriors. Like, everyone would do that. It's still, you've got three incredible shooters on the court. And again, those two guys with their ability to make plays, you know, you've got to choose between, you're either going to close out soft and just give up the open three, which may be the best choice, or if you close out too hard, then you're making yourself vulnerable to those guys driving.
All right, we got to get more into this Rockets conversation. It actually goes to a great quote that Igor Kokoschkov gave me earlier this year, because I think there's about three elements here. So we're talking with Kevin Pelton of ESPN. Make sure you click on his articles, read his great stuff, piece on Draymond Green if he's a Hall of Famer, Colangelo piece and best postseason runs all up on ESPN.com right now. All right, so Houston, as you mentioned, was obsessed with the Warriors. So what they did is they built their entire defense, their entire roster for the blueprint to stop the Warriors. And frankly, they did it. They discombobulated the Warriors. The Warriors didn't look good. It took a Chris Paul injury and a million missed threes and to this day, we'll never know what might have happened if those two things didn't happen. So they did it. Is that now a blueprint for what everyone else tries to follow?
I think it is for certain teams, and you know that's going to be one of the challenges. I also think Boston is to some extent a blueprint, although it's easier to do this again if you have the third pick in consecutive drafts because of the fact that you happen to have made a brilliant trade 5 years ago that continues to pay dividends. The one question is, do you want to focus on the Warriors specifically if you're building your team for, two or three years down the road when this team may not have the same players on it, and at the very least, you know, they'll be at a different stage in their career than they are now? I don't think it's specifically the Warriors, but I think that just generally speaking, that's probably going to be at the highest levels of basketball. Switching is going to remain an important tool defensively, because of course we saw it at the other end of the court in the Warriors Rockets series too, and that managed to take the Rockets out of their offense just as effectively what the Warriors were able to do switching. So, I think when you get to that level of offensive talent, you're not going to want to get put in rotations by defending the pick and roll, by hedging or trapping or doing anything like that. And that switching is probably going to remain the best option at that level.
All right, so this gets to the next thing that I think's most interesting. So Igor Kokoschkov said to me, early in the playoffs, you can alter your offense in a playoff series, but when you try to change your defensive structure in a playoff series, you're asking five guys to work collectively at something they haven't trained or done before. And so defense is about habits and repetition and understanding. So the switching thing you're talking about, I think what we're seeing in Cleveland right now is a team that's trying to implement it on the fly, and they miss just all the time, right? And Houston didn't miss at all because it's what they had done all season long. So if you're going to try to build this, you have to build it from day one of training camp if you believe what Igor Kokoschkov said.
100% agree with that. And yeah, I think that's what set Houston apart this year from past years. And it's also an element of what has made Golden State so successful. I mean, they're not as extreme in terms of switching as Houston is, but they're, you know, a solid number two in the league. And they've been doing this since Steve Kerr got there and Draymond Green became the power forward. And so therefore, you know, that's years of that collective knowledge that they have in terms of how to execute this defensively that you've got to try to match if you're going to be able to compete with them.
So is Draymond Green a Hall of Famer?
I mean, I think he's well on his way. He's 28, so you know he's still got a bulk of his career left. If he decided to retire tomorrow to become, I don't know, an MMA fighter or something, you know, then he's probably not a Hall of Famer.
Why is he not more replicable?
I mean, the combination of the physical tools that, you know, aside from his size, but the athleticism of his size, the strength, and then the will, I mean, there's not a lot of guys out there like that.
So the will I got, like, he's insane. That's obvious anytime you watch him. You know, it's interesting. So the Warriors deserve all sorts of credit because they drafted him and they also passed on him a bunch of times, right? They had a pick. You know, I love their story now. Oh, we thought Draymond would slip more. If you were discussing that, you didn't think Draymond was who he was.
Tobias has admitted that.
Right. Like, so why, what is it if we're looking with the draft or the future, like what is it that wasn't recognized about him that has made him at 28 on path to be a Hall of Famer?
I mean, the weird thing is, and I say this even as someone whose draft projections liked Draymond quite a bit and, you know, was a fan of his and supporter of his before the draft, I thought that was all at the offensive end. I thought that he was going to be, you know, so versatile offensively with his playmaking. And, you know, I thought he was going to be a better shooter in the NBA than he ended up being based on his college results, that I'm like, okay, yeah, he might not be able to find a position defensively, but that's not a concern. So, you know, I think part of what happened is, and Steve Kerr, I feel like, has talked a lot about this. At some point it went from he doesn't have a position defensively to, oh, he's versatile enough to defend multiple positions. And getting in better shape helped that too. That's also something that should be mentioned in this. You know, that's part of why he dropped. If he were in the same shape he is now when he was at Michigan State, he probably would have been a higher regarded draft prospect. So there's all those things come into play, but definitely, you know, the importance of switching and the value of the ability to play multiple positions becoming more important has helped him. I don't think he's replicable. The guy I think is somewhat replicable is PJ Tucker. I think that's the guy I'd be looking for in this year's draft.
And Draymond Green, and PJ Tucker really is a poor man's Draymond Green without the handle.
Yeah, I mean, it's an easier set of skills to find. I mean, you still have to have incredible strength for being 6'6" and good foot speed and everything like that. And then, you know, the same kind of dogged intensity at the defensive end. We see similar in PJ Tucker to Draymond Green. But I do think there's an interesting player in this year's draft who has a somewhat similar collection of skills and has dropped because he has kind of dropped because of the fact that he dealt with injuries as a senior, and that's Bondi Colson from Notre Dame.
All right, I'll look him up. It's interesting.
I mean, same kind of story where he's been a big man his entire life, you know, a 4, even a 5 for Notre Dame. And, you know, if you're looking at him 10 years ago when PJ Tucker was in the draft or 12 years ago, whatever it was, you'd say, oh, well, there's no way he can play as a big man at his size and he can't shoot well enough to be a small forward. So he's got no future in the NBA. And that's how PJ Tucker ends up playing overseas for several years. But now, you know, that again, that instead of being a tweener defensively, now you're versatile defensively. So I think he could benefit from something similar.
All right. So, what do you, let's go to the post up back. Let's go back to this concept. So if everyone's switching, the in vogue thing is that the post up is the answer. Zach wrote about it 2 years ago. He's mentioned that a lot recently. You mentioned it there. It's on television. Is the post up, even on a mismatch, an efficient offensive play?
I think it is if you can draw a double team. And we've seen that at times from the Warriors where they've been willing to double team this series when it's Kevin Love or LeBron in the post. I mean, part of the challenge that, you know, part of the reason the Warriors can get away with switching as much as they do and almost inviting these mismatches is the fact that they're going to make it really difficult for you to enter the ball into the post. And then when they do double team or get into rotation, they're going to execute that better than anyone else. And, you know, I recall I have a specific vision in my mind of a play last night where there was some mismatch and the defender was kind of on the left side of the player posting, Cleveland player posting up. And then Jordan Bell comes in from the right side and times it perfectly to knock the ball away. They didn't end up with a steal. The ball got knocked out of bounds, but at least you got out of that mismatch with that well-timed help. But yeah, I mean, it probably is something that becomes more important against switching defenses than it does against more traditional ones.
All right. So I've talked to coaches about this. Coaches are very nervous of the post up for a lot of reasons. One of which is a lot of the coaches I've talked to feel is the minute people start posting up more, you deny the entry pass for even the slightest amount of time, and people can bump out of the post very quickly. So that Steph Curry is pinned, Draymond's coming in, or somebody else is coming in. By the time that ball gets there, you no longer have a mismatch, and you've worked a ton of time on the clock to go get it.
Right. That's the scram or kick-out switch that we've seen a lot of in this postseason with Boston and Golden State and Houston all employing that, I would say.
And so the feeling from coaches is, boy, you really can get suckered trying to go get that post up. You with them on that?
Yeah. No, I think that's a completely reasonable take. I tend to find the post up part of it kind of overstated here. I think that, you know, the finding the weakest link defensively and isolating them is probably a slightly better way to go against switching defenses. And then also, maybe it's not replicable.
Let me interrupt you right there, because I think that's where I was trying to get to. I think that's really important. For all this talk of the post-up and everything else, I'm still not convinced it's that efficient a play, even on a mismatch, particularly with the threat of them being able to bump out of it instead of double, and you get late in the clock, that you're probably better off doing exactly what you just said, which is what everyone hates to somehow decide, that throwing into the post is better than the dreaded, you know, find your defensive weakness if you're switching and play one-on-one. But I think you just hit it right there, Kevin. I think it's still a better play to go play one-on-one.
Right. And the other thing I'm interested to see is, you know, and maybe this, again, for the same reason we talked about with the switching for everyone but the Rockets, is impossible to replicate because of the chemistry. But, you know, the Warriors' ability against switches to, you know, okay, if it's a big guy on Steph, we're going to go move Steph off screens, particularly the ones where he's been passing the ball to one of their bigs and then getting a handoff from that that's acting as a screen for him. Like, is there more we can do to that so that our offense doesn't completely stagnate against switches, but that we're still taking advantage of those mismatches in a different way?
Are you talking about the plays in the corner where where you really, but the key to that whole play is you almost have to use the sideline as another defender.
Cleveland did that very well in game three.
Right. I'm not sure you can do that same handoff. The only way you can do that same handoff to deal with the switching, is if you're running away from the basket.
But that specific action aside, in general, the Warriors do a better job of let's move you around and make you defend a smaller, quicker player in space rather than just making you do that in an isolation play.
Yes. All right, let's discuss some players who have either ISO or pick and roll skills that might be more valuable than people perceive as this game moves this way, as we continue with Kevin Pelton here on Locked On NBA, your daily bite-sized 30-minute NBA podcast. It's part of the Locked On Podcast Network. All right. Harrison Barnes, oft criticized. No, I mean, really, like really often criticized. Isolation player from hell. Suddenly valuable?
No, I don't think he's efficient enough doing it. Here's another thing we should probably bring up before we have this conversation, is it's not just the isolation. It's the isolation with the ability to make three in isolation, which obviously the Warriors guards have. And then that was such a big part of what James Harden did. And even Chris Paul added it more to his game, although, you know, he can get away with the mid-range isolations because he's so successful at that. So I just don't know if Barnes, you know, is going to ever be efficient enough to get there.
If we look at the top 90 guys in the league who took isolation plays last year, they took 90 or – what's the sample size, by the way? That's the weird thing. You're trying to figure out who's good at these things, isolation and post-ups, and we don't have sample sizes that are big enough because nobody's doing them in the league, and now they suddenly become important. Like, do you need 300? Do you need 100? What's your feeling on sample size to be able to figure out who you're buying that's a legitimate post-up or isolation player?
I would probably not look at anyone with less than 100. I don't know. You know, I haven't looked at kind of what the year-to-year consistency on that is, though.
Julius Randle suddenly becoming more valuable free agent. He's a decent isolation player at a point per possession. He's got a decent post-up game.
And he's someone who the strength of his game defensively is going to always be switching. So, yes, I think Julius Randle does qualify.
So he hits as a good at a good time for a... All right, Nikola Jokic, who likes to pat, I mean, is already incredibly offensive, valuable player. Does he become more valuable because you now, if they switch it, you're sending him into the post, on or are they already? Is he already there because of his passing skills?
Yeah, I think it may be a little because he's kind of the rich man's Horford in terms of if you want to kind of, you know, bring two to the ball, defending a ball screen involving him, then you have to give up the open three, and he's good enough to make that efficiently. But defensively, it probably hurts him more defensively than it helps offensively because you're never going to want to switch with Jokic on defense.
Two very good offensive players that are very bad isolation players. Paul George and Bradley Beal. Any concern on them?
I mean, you know, again, this is talking about what level we're talking about. You know, the Wizards haven't really gotten to the point in the playoffs where they've faced these kind of switching defenses. It's also a matter of who you have around you. I mean, you know, I think the odds are wherever Paul George goes this summer, the odds are pretty good that he's not going to be their best player or their best option to attack these kind of isolations. And in that case, it's somewhat less important.
By the way, a weird one when I was preparing for this, that of a player that is not particularly good in either post-up or isolation, that I was really surprised, Anthony Davis.
Yeah, that is surprising. You would think he would be good at both of those.
Like his direct post-up, according to Second Spectrum, is 0.92, and his isolations are like 0.7.
But he does tend to be a player who doesn't create his own shot particularly well. It tends to be more effective than someone else's city a lot.
All right, so are those players, and I think that's what we just found on Bradley Beal and Paul George also. Are those players,
right,
as this game becomes more isolation and more switching defense, are those players going to see a slight downtick and we're going to be like wondering why did this happen? And that's the reason.
A little. I mean, I don't think it's as dramatic as someone like, for example, Capella in that series against the Warriors, where until he was so dominant on the offensive glass until game seven, they were able to kind of take him out of that series by their ability to switch everything. And then just the effectiveness of their help defense when he did have a mismatch. But, you know, these guys are, I think, a level better in that regard than someone like Capella. And that, by the way, is another way you can punish switches. I think it was maybe Vin Falk tweeted something about this at some point during the playoffs about how high the offensive rebound rate was within a few seconds after a switch. So, you know, if you're an Anthony Davis, if you're a Clint Capella, part of the solution is just if you're going to isolate your guard against the big out on the perimeter, that allows you against a guard to get to the offensive glass and create second chances.
You are not allowed on Offensive Rebound Island. You rebuked me earlier this year when I sent you an invitation to Offensive Rebound Island on this exact podcast. You said no. I offered you a first class free one-way ticket onto Offensive Rebound Island, and you declined, and we had great service waiting for you. Grapes and feet rubs, and you were going to be treated like a king, and you declined. And the passageway onto Offensive Rebound Island is not open to you anymore.
My recollection is that instead of hanging out on either Offensive Rebound Island or Get Back in Transition Defense Island, that I was like working the bridge in between those two loadouts.
Right. So you drowned in the middle of the ocean for having no opinion and were eaten by sharks. I, as you know, so for those who've missed it, 5 years ago, the offensive rebounding rate in the NBA was like 27% of all shots. 10 years ago, it was like 29%. This year, it was down at 21%. In fact, there was only one team in the entire NBA whose offensive rebounding rate was above the average of 5 years ago. And because the swing has gone so far to no offensive rebounding, I believe that offensive rebounding has increased value.
I think that's probably accurate.
Oh, wait a sec. Mark it down. Maybe the first time ever that I might have got a reversal out of Pelton on one of my ideas.
I'm coming around to it.
All right. So what does that mean in this regard to how you build a team and players you're looking for?
Well, I think one of the things it means is that it becomes more valuable than to have guards who can box out and rebound, which I think Jeff Van Gundy mentioned on the broadcast last night, where, you know, there was a play where Curry comes down and takes the ball away from Tristan Thompson as he was about to secure an offensive rebound. And, you know, that's not the first skill you think of, nearly the first skill you think of, but it is a useful little thing about Steph Curry.
Well, no, I mean, Jerry Sloan always used to say, one of your guards has to average 5 rebounds a game if you're going to win a title. Now, the game might have changed a little bit, but that was always his theory, is that one of your 2 guards had to really rebound.
Yeah, that's probably the case.
All right, what do we have left? What have we left out here? Let's talk.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I want to talk about the way that this impacts players defensively, because it makes me start to wonder about how good Trae Young is going to have to be on offense to make up for the fact that he is going to be a target of switching defenses throughout his career.
Yeah, I mean, what is the minimum size? I'm going to take it a little bit of a different angle rather than specifically to Trae Young, because I probably don't have the answer on Trae Young. I'll get yours in a second. What's the minimum size now?
I mean, I don't know if there's a minimum size, but I think that, you know, you're paying a greater penalty for putting a smaller player on the court at this point. And so you better be able to make up for it offensively or just be so competitive defensively. So, I mean, you know, Terry Rozier has been able to keep up, even though he, you know, some of Boston's lineups in the fourth quarter, they at times would go with Marcus Smart at point guard. So you didn't have Rozier out there. But, I mean, as much as I love him, how could Isaiah Thomas play in this year's conference finals or finals?
No, I don't. And so what is your thought on Trae Young?
I mean, he's a fascinating prospect to me, and I still haven't fully formulated my thoughts. But I think that seeing this trend towards more switching defensively makes me somewhat lower on him because of the fact that you're going to pay a bigger penalty on defense for having him out there.
I'm a little worried about your influence on my family. My daughter just walked into me, showed her the phone notification. Is Draymond Green a Hall of Famer? -Kevin Pelton that she just got on her phone.
Nice.
Do I really need my 13-year-old reading? Probably do. Probably better than most things, my 13-year-old. But, you know. I find the size thing fascinating. I was watching a workout with Brunson and Holiday. I'm not going to get into too many specifics because I'm not really supposed to. And that was like watching Aaron and watching Holiday and Brunson. Like that was what I was thinking. Like if they play in the Western Conference, like Ricky Rubio is like the smallest guard they see.
That's interesting. I mean, yeah, I'm thinking of it more in terms of the mismatches when you're defending a bigger opponent, but that's an issue too. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so yeah. I mean, even. Like just on the core, I mean, CJ, it's a little bit. All right, so what's the size difference between CJ McCollum and Trae Young?
Young is, you know, I think at this point, like CJ's pretty well built for his size. At this point, Young is not as filled out as someone like Steph, who has relatively similar dimensions.
Well, I mean, the reason I'm bringing that up is because CJ McCollum, I actually think, is 6'3", 200 now, 6'3", 190. And Trae Young smaller than that. And everybody's talking about CJ, or not everyone, but a lot of conversation about CJ McCollum is whether or not he's a defensive liability and whether that's a real problem. And that's why the Blazers got swept in all those conversations of a few weeks ago. And so I was taking like that compare. Does Trae Young then have to be CJ McCollum-esque offensively?
I think the difference is that CJ is playing with another small guard, and Lillard, Trae Young presumably would be your point guard.
Okay. And he's 6'1", right?
He's listed at 6'2", I think. Just had this pulled up. Yeah, he's listed at 6'2", 180.
Do we have? I don't have combine. The stealing of talent by ESPN has made it harder to find combine results than once was on measurements for me. You're probably better at it than I am.
Let's see. If he, in the shoe, adjusting for the average height of shoes, he clocks in at 6'1 and a quarter and 178.
It's pretty small.
Yes.
Like, I think you might have to be 6'4".
I don't think you have to be 6'4", but you might have to be six, but again, you have to be really, really good offensively to make up for it.
Right. All right. So you have to be 6'4" unless you're a superstar at something else. Donovan's 6'3", right? Like Donovan's 6'3", his arms are 6'9" or 6'8", and he seems to be okay.
Yeah, he doesn't play 6'3".
Huh?
His effective size out there on the court is not that of a 6'3" player.
Right. Amen. So now if you're going to be – okay. I mean, I guess – so the other question is to the draft, and then we'll wrap this up. Rudy Gobert lacks some of these things for switchability and things like that, but he is the best defensive player in the entire NBA. Mo Bamba is being talked about as the next Rudy Gobert. Does he have to be the best defensive player in the NBA to play without the skills that both those guys don't have?
No, because Rudy Gobert is the best defensive player in the NBA. I heard one person close to the situation to describe him repeatedly as a top 10 talent throughout the season.
And I will still hold to that. And if you'd like to get off that island, I will blockade that island for you too.
I'm willing to take that chance. I'm driving off. I don't care if the gate comes down after me.
By the way, can I give you a suggestion? Unless you have a duck boat, stop driving off islands.
fair point. I just thought that was a better visual.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you're from Seattle, so you got a duck boat as your regular car. I don't know.
There's a wide gulf between Rudy Gobert and not capable of playing, and I think Mo Bamba will probably end up somewhere in that dramatic in between.
On that note, Kevin Pelton's driving skills are not good if he's driving. I can't wait to see the duck boat coming from Seattle to Portland every year. KP, great work. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Is LeBron's postseason run one of the best ever? Kevin's written that recently. Draymond Green, a Hall of Famer. Also break down the Colangelo issues as well. We got a lot more to talk about. We're out of time. Kevin, you're the best. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to today's Locked On NBA. Anthony will be with you, coming with Adam Mattis tomorrow for the Locked On Podcast Friday edition. And then starting Wednesday is the Locked On NBA mock draft, something that's unequaled anywhere else in NBA coverage. It's the Locked On NBA Podcast Network, your team every day.